program. And in my opinion, the condensed matter is the most exciting field of physics, and I hope that you're going to feel some of that excitement. And I try to current, the most up-to-date topics that people are interested in these days. And before I start, we'll do it first.
I just want to do a quick round of names. I'm not guaranteeing that I'll remember everything, but I'll try to get to know you. And please, you know, later on, don't hesitate to come introduce yourself. I have an office here in the third floor and also in the main building, in also the third floor, 30361. So why don't we start? Tell me, your name, maybe some little background, where you come from, what you're interested in, why you like physics, something.
My name is Leva. I went to undergrad at Kent State University in Ohio, and I'm not really sure what I'm doing yet.
I'm Rolf. I'm from Grad. I made my undergrad history at University of Laval, and that's it.
So I'm not from Quebec, but I'm going to Quebec next year. So I'm, I didn't say. Now I'm located in California. I'm doing my postdoc. Next year I'm going to start as a faculty at McGill University.
I'm Shane from Australia. I'm interested in biophysics and cosmology.
I'm Catherine. I'm also from Australia. I'm interested in cosmology.
I'm Anton from South Africa, and I like QFT and string theory.
My name is Antti. I'm from Finland, University of Turku. I'm mostly interested in pure math, but now I'm slipping towards quantum information.
Hi, I'm Laura. I'm from the same university as he is, and I'm interested in quantum stuff.
My name is Bruno. I'm from Portugal. I studied at Porto University. I'm interested in cholesterol.
My name is Solomon. I'm from Nigeria. I went to EMS, and I came here in PI to study cholesterol.
My name is Jose. I come from Colombia, and I'm interested in condensed matter and quantum information.
My name is Peter. I come from the United States, Indiana, and I'm interested in that.
Dennis, I know what you're interested in.
And are we exempt from? Okay, let me introduce myself. My name is Denis Dalidovich, originally from Russia, but I have just become a Canadian citizen 2 days ago. I'm the tutor of the students at PSI, and my area of specialization is condensed matter as well.
Okay, my name is Ajay, and I'm working in AACFP. I'm a graduate student at PI, and I'll be DA for this book.
I'm Joachim Safini. I did my undergrad in Cameroon, and I'm interested in condensed matter slash quantum info.
I'm Callum. I'm one of the other tutors. I'm tutoring the string theory explorations book. From the UK, like quantum field theories in general.
I'm Holger, I'm from Estonia, did my undergrad in Bristol, England, and I'm interested in quantum information and condensed matter.
My name is Maita. I came here from Germany via MIT, and I want to do quantum information.
And you were like,
my name is Yang, and I did my undergrad at the University of Washington here, and I'm interested in quantum information and experimental aspects.
Great. Okay, so now that we know each other, we can go on. So let me first maybe introduce the three topics that I chose for you. It's kind of hard to choose because there are many interesting topics. I choose things that, A, I'm interested in, be there in two dimensions, and I think the most interesting physics happens in two dimensions, and I hope to convince you of that. Of course, things also sometimes carry on to one dimension or two or three dimensions, but we're going to focus on two. And also, I chose these topics because they sort of lead to one another. It's always hard to choose because there are so many other good stuff. But if you feel like it, you can always drop by my office and, you know, discuss things that are either in this class or not. The first one is graphene. We're going to start that in a second. The second one is the quantum Hall effect, which is the one topic that I didn't actually write any single paper about. So I had to learn it before giving these talks. But the interest in quantum Hall effect started in the 80s, where people started to realize that there is something to do with topology that will actually affect the physics. And I think that was the first example of Berry phase was in magnetic field. And even more exciting things happen when you introduce large magnetic fields and when your systems are clean. You get from the integer quantum Hall effect to the fractional quantum Hall effect. And before you know it, you have excitations that are nanobillion anions. So many exotic things actually happen in condensed matter, even though we start with things that you can build in the laboratory. So that's going to be next week. And basically putting these two things together is going to lead us to topological insulators, which is a very young field that just started something like 5 years ago, I think. And the best way to describe a two-dimensional topological insulator would be a quantum Hall effect without magnetic field. But we'll get to that. That's all very exciting. But first, let's just start with graphene. Graphene made headlines last year when, I guess, they only got the Nobel Prize in November, when Geim and Novoselov got the Nobel Prize for, let's say, achieving graphene experimentally. And they didn't discover it because they actually made it. But apparently, just to give you some stories, it wasn't so hard to make graphene. It was harder to actually find it once you make it. So you can make graphene yourself whenever you take your pencil and you draw a line on your substrate, which would be the paper. You actually take layers of graphite. Graphite is a layered material. You take one layer and move it onto the paper. So of course you take many layers. But if you had a really good AFM microscope, atomic force microscope, you could maybe find flakes that are only a single layer. So for a long time, people tried to actually grow graphene and to do many techniques to get this one-dimensional layer onto, let's say, some substrate with no conductivity and see what happened. And one prominent person was Walter Heer from Georgia Tech. But he, even though he invested most of his career on graphene, he didn't really win the race first. But the people who did it were Andrew Geim and Konstantin Novoselov from Manchester University. And if you ask them how they did it, for the general public, we say mechanical exfoliation. Within our own physics circle, we can say scotch tape method, because what they basically did is took some scotch tape, put it on graphite, and peeled it off. And here you go, you have graphene on a substrate. And then, of course, the challenge was to find a flake that is big enough that is actually going to be your sample, and to actually realize that it's only one atomic layer thick. And for that, you need a lot of skill. And this field has evolved a little bit since. There is now also graphene that is made through molecular beam epitaxy or some other methods of growing on different substrates. And And even though this, all of this business exploded in 2004, and we got, I think the Nobel Prize is one of the youngest ones. We didn't wait too much to get this Nobel Prize. The interest in graphene started a long time ago. And the reason was that graphite was a pretty interesting material back in the day, say in the 50s and 60s, and even before that. And in fact, the people worked out the band structure in 1948. And the reason I want to mention that is just we're in Canada, and the guy who actually wrote the first band structure for graphene was Phil Wallace, that was Canadian, graduate of University of Toronto, and then worked at NRC and McGill and other institutes. But let's just first, before we dive into the theory of graphene, let's just look at some experiments. So this is my experiment to make graphene. These are the first crystals from Under Gein's group. Two things I want you to see. One is that this is a pretty big crystal. For anything in condensed matter, when you're beyond the micron size, this is a big sample that you can do basic research on. And there are two types of edges. We will look into edges, I think, tomorrow, if we manage to get there. One edge is the zigzag edge. So I didn't say, but I assume you knew already, that graphene is a honeycomb lattice of carbon atoms. If you cut the honeycomb lattice this way, it's called the zigzag edge. If you cut it this way or this way, it's called the armchair edge. We'll see that very peculiar states reside on a zigzag edge just by the fact that you took this graphene material and cut it somewhere. You'll get some interesting edge states. Nowadays, we also have suspended graphene. So I talked about Scotch tape method and having the substrate. So you might say, oh, this is not exactly two-dimensional. We had quasi-two-dimensional things before. But actually, graphene can be suspended. So if you look at this picture, these are like rods of some substrate, and the thing you see here is graphene, which is basically stretched on between these two rods. Interesting features of suspended graphene are the curvature. So if you have this experience of trying to put some shrink wrap over something, over a bowl maybe, you can't ever make it really flat. So this is what happens to graphene, and actually these ripples and wrinkles are very interesting. And one can look at the curvature of graphene and formulate it in an effective gauge field. And this effective gauge field can do many interesting things depending on its symmetries and so on. I don't know if you mentioned ARPES experiments in John's class. ARPES is angle resolved photoemission. We shine light on something, and an electron comes out. From the direction of the electron coming out, if it's only two dimensions, we know the momentum, if we know the energy, and we know the energy because of the frequency of the shined light. So we can basically map which quantum states in our sample the electron is coming from, and then we can measure it in all directions. This is only a 2D plot, but you can actually get 3D plots from ARPES. So this is just along one momentum direction, and this is the energy. And what the most, let's say, celebrated feature of graphene is that it has a Dirac point. So the energy goes to zero, and two Dirac cones meet. And we'll talk about that in a second. You have linear dispersion. This is very unusual in condensed matter systems. If you think about it in perturbation theory, whenever you have two bands meet, any little perturbation is going to lift this degeneracy. But It doesn't happen in graphene, and you do see the Dirac point here. And there's, and the slope is actually giving you what would be the speed of light in photons, and here it's the Fermi velocity, which is very high actually. It's only a factor of 300 less than the speed of light. As I said, you could induce a gap really easily, and this is actually a gap that is suspected to be induced either by the substrate or by interactions. I vote for interactions just because it's more interesting, but there are many reasons to believe one or the other, so it's still an open question. This is also an ARPES picture. ARPES is one of these methods that theorists really love, because you can measure something that is directly related to the Green's function or to the self-energy. We'll talk about that also. Bilayer graphene, we're going to touch that a little bit. So we worked really hard to find a single layer of graphene, but it turns out that if you took two layers together, then there's also some interesting physics. If you do the bend structure, you see that instead of a single Dirac cone where you have these crossing linear bands, you actually have parabolic bands, but you still have a zero gap here. And it might be also that the bilayer is more sensitive to interactions. So also we might expect that interesting things are going to happen in one layer, in bilayer. One interesting suggestion was that you could get into a state which is BEC, which is Bose condensation, Bose-Einstein condensation of excitons, which are excitations from one layer to another. So this is bilayer graphene. And last thing is electron and hole puddles. So one thing that makes people excited about graphene from the experimental side is that it's easily controllable. It's like a zero-gap semiconductor, but you can very easily change the Fermi level by gating it. But it turns out you don't even have to gate it. By itself, probably induced by some disorder, either by the ripples or by some impurities, it is self-doped. So what you're looking at here is a map that was measured by this device. So the measurement is compressibility, and it's actually proportional to the number of carriers. And what you see here is regions of high density and regions of low density. And since we talked about the Dirac point, if we have half-filled system, which means that every carbon atom is giving one electron to the conduction C, then we'll have exactly zero density. So we'll call that zero density. Anything below that is making holes in one of the cones. Anything above that is adding electrons to the upper cone. So zero density is where only one band, the lower cone, is full and the upper cone is empty. But here we see that you actually have electron and hole puddles. Okay, and that's the last experiment I want to show. Let me just... Okay. So let's just go on and look at graphene. The first thing that you always have to think about when you look at a condensed matter system is, can I write tight binding? So if you open a simple textbook like Ashcroft and Merming, they're going to talk with you about crystallography, and they're going to talk with you about tight binding, which is just a way to look at the kinetic energy of electrons in the lattice. So let's write the tight binding of graphene. Let's put T here. So have you seen anything on the lattice before? Have you worked with, yeah, okay, good. So basically, all I'm writing here is that there is some probability T for electrons to hop from site I to site J. Let's add spin, but for now I'm going to work with a spinless model, or everything. You can suppose that everything has the same spin. And this symbol means nearest neighbors. But I want to go on and say that actually my lattice has a certain form. So let me just draw the lattice maybe here. So if you did study crystallography, you would know that the honeycomb lattice is not a Bravais lattice. So Bravais lattice is when you sit on one side or move to another side, you see the same thing. And you already see that this atom sees two neighbors down and one neighbor out. And this atom would see one neighbor down and two neighbors up. So let's call this A sublattice and this B sublattice. So there are two kinds of sites. And there's only hopping between A and B. So what I want to do is actually say that I'm going over all sites I and all nearest neighbors delta, and I'm going from CI dagger to DI plus delta plus Hermitian conjugate. So I'm putting the A sublattice, I'm giving it C creation operators and D for the B sublattice. And I can also write it in a matrix form. Something like that, for example, where my psi would be CI DI. And now I just need to define my unit cell. So let's say that this is a unit cell. Let's call it A and B. I have a basis vector, tau, that takes me from A to B. And I can write everything in matrix form. And who can tell me what to do next? I want to find the spectrum. I want to find the spectrum. What do I have to do? I could diagonalize the matrix, but actually I still have many, many degrees of freedom. I wrote it in, let's say if I have n atoms, this is an n, or if I have n, let's say unit cells, I have n by n matrix here and n by n matrix here. So I need to diagonalize. Space, sorry, say that again? That's nearly free. You're basically, you're saying that there are sites, it's bound to sites, but you gain kinetic energy by hopping from one site to another. But okay, what do you do in a model when you have symmetries? So if I have a symmetry, that means that my Hamiltonian, let's say I have a symmetry which I call T, my Hamiltonian commutes with that, so I can simultaneously diagonalize my Hamiltonian and that particular symmetry. And the symmetry we think we have until we find out that we actually have a dirty sample, but if our system is clean, we think we have translational invariance. Okay? So in this case, it's not, I don't have translational invariance between the A and the B, but whenever I go from A to A, let's say, I see the same thing. And the same here. From B to B. So I have translational invariance and I have these lattice vectors. So since I have translational invariance, I can diagonalize the translation operator. And this brings me to the Bloch theorem, which basically tells me that I need to Fourier transform, that the eigenstates of the system are going to be, let's say, some I is going to be some e to the I, let's say, give it a label k, e to the k dot ri, some u, which is periodic, u of r, okay, which is periodic inside. And we're just going to forget about this. This function contains what happens within a short distance from the atom. So we'll forget about it and just assume it's some constant. And we'll basically Fourier transform. And I want to say that my psi at point r is a sum over k e to the minus I k dot r psi k. And once I do that, tight binding gives me something very nice, because let's say I have a site ri here and I have rj here. What I get is pk e to the I p minus k. Let's call it times ri minus I k r j. Okay, so I had a factor I p r I from this, and k times r I, let's call it delta. Okay, so e to the minus I k r I plus delta, which is going to be the distance between r I and r j, attached here, and psi k psi p, or sorry, psi p psi k. So this is something we always do when we have translational invariance. And what it gives us is that if we sum here over all of Ri, this actually drops out. So the sum of this exponent in the lattice is basically going to give us delta k minus p up to a reciprocal lattice vector. So it's the same as in real space and free space, but just up to lattice momentum. So let me just do that. So to do that, basically, all I'm left with is this factor. And I want to do it in the following way. So this is minus t sum over k k dagger gamma k, okay? And what is gamma k? So let's look at A, sublattice A. Gamma k is just going to be the sum of the over the nearest neighbors of sublattice A, e to the I k dot delta. So it is just e to the I k y over root 3. This is this neighbor. And then I have two neighbors here. This is this neighbor, and I have two neighbors here. This one and this one. It gives me e to the minus I k y over 2 root 3, 2 cos kx over 2. So this is gamma. Okay. So now what do? I still didn't find the spectrum, but I got a little closer, because now you see my Hamiltonian is diagonal in momentum. So momentum is the eigenstate of the translation operator. And I diagonalized with respect to that. So I don't have, these are not matrices anymore. These are just numbers. Before I had big matrices, n by n. Now all of the n goes here. I have n k vectors, but and I have only a number here, but I just still have a matrix form. Okay, so what do I do next?
Diagonalize the matrix.
Diagonalize the matrix. And even though it's 2 by 2, and that's a matrix that's easy to diagonalize, I just choose to square it instead. So if I square that matrix, so let's call that a matrix, I just get gamma k squared. Gamma k squared. Because it's a number, I didn't have to worry about the order. If you have an operator, like we had before, you could still do that trick of squaring. This is just an aside. Actually, Witten used that trick to talk about supersymmetry. So supersymmetric Hamiltonians are ones that are squares of other operators. And there are neat tricks that are all under the name of supersymmetric quantum mechanics that one can do with Hamiltonians that are squares of other operators. In condensed matter, and I think we're going to do it next week. No, we're going to do it tomorrow. You can sometimes use some of these tricks, and you define an auxiliary Hamiltonian just by squaring your Hamiltonian. But here, it's just for the purpose of finding the spectrum, because if I know the spectrum of h squared, I also know the spectrum of h. So my what is the spectrum then? I have a different energy for each k, and it's plus minus gamma k. So what does that look like? So first of all, I have to introduce the Brillouin zone. Did you use Brillouin zones before? Okay. So I mentioned before that the lattice is only the momentum is only defined up to a reciprocal lattice vector. So anything within the Brillouin zone. Is a well-defined momentum. So the Brillouin zone is sort of the periodicity of the momentum space. So since everything is defined up to reciprocal lattice vector, I don't have to give you any momentum outside this Brillouin zone because I can always, let's say this is a reciprocal lattice vector, so I can always shift it and find the equivalent inside the Brillouin zone. So it's just the smallest piece of momentum space that we have to look in. And for the honeycomb lattice, we actually don't have a Brillouin zone because it's not a Bravais lattice. It's not periodic. We do have a Brillouin zone for this triangular lattice that we were using. So let's say just for the A, for example. And the fact we have two atoms in the unit cell mean that we're going to get two bands. And indeed, we did get two bands. Ek is plus minus this gamma k. And let me just give you the coordinates here. This is 4 pi over 3. And this is 2 pi over 3, 2 pi over root 3. And the rest you can just rotate and find. it happens so that this gamma k actually goes to zero on these corners of the Brillouin zone. By the way, the choice of the reciprocal unit cell, which is here I chose the Brillouin zone. There's a procedure how to define the Brillouin zone, but you can choose a different zone if you so wish. You could just do that. And in any case, gamma k goes to zero here, and in fact, this is where the two bands meet. So if I go close to this point, let's say I go along kx, and this is one of the experiments I showed you, you'll see that the bands actually cross. But of course, I need to look at the three-dimensional graph of energy versus a two-dimensional sheet of momentum. But here, I can just draw two. And anywhere here, I will find that the bands meet, and they meet in this Dirac cone-like fashion. It turns out that we have actually two Dirac points. And why am I saying we have two? If you look at it, it looks like I have six. Each one of them is only included, only a third of each one of them is included in the Brillouin zone. So I have only two. I call these ones, let's say this one, and this one, I call them K, big K. And the other ones, this one, and this one, I call K prime. And the reason for that is that they're not equivalent. So why aren't they equivalent? They both look like that in terms of dispersion. But they're not exactly the same when I look at the Hamiltonian. And now the last thing I want to get to in this lecture is to get to the spectrum at these points, at these Dirac points, because the spectrum here is only, is at low energy, looks like Dirac, the Dirac cone, not at high energy, but actually it turns out that for many, many properties, it's enough to look at the linearized model next to these nodes. So usually in condensed matter, we have parabolic bands. If you think of tight binding on any square lattice, you'll just get cosine kx plus cosine ky, and things just go smoothly, and then there's the bottom of the band, and if you're only filling a few electrons, you'll have, by contrast, let's say this is, you'll have a Fermi level like that, and if you're next to the bottom of the band, you can maybe linearize there, but you'll find nothing linear here. As you go here, you'll find some linearity as you fill this band. And actually, in two dimensions, 2D electron gases that we know of in semiconductors like gallium arsenide, you can't fill the bands too much. So this vector here, which we can call the Fermi vector, is relatively small. There are just a few full states here. This Fermi circle is small. Here, we're at the extreme point where the Fermi circle that we might have had if our Fermi level was here, it actually shrinks to a point here. But even though we're at the bottom of the band, if you wish, we can still linearize. There is still something non-zero to linearize against. So here, if I wanted to approximate, I would write something like k squared. So I can even write k squared over 2m and say, oh, this reminds me of free electrons. Here I cannot do it. It doesn't remind me of free electrons. It reminds me of free Dirac particles. And let's just see why that is. You know what? You don't actually have to see much. What you have to do is put in here one, let's say I want to do it at gamma of k equals 4 pi over 3, 0. So right at this Dirac point. So this is 1. This is one, and I have 2 cosine of 2 pi over 3, which is minus a half, and it's 0. Now, if I wanted to expand, and I take k to be k plus a little q, then I'll get gamma q, which is actually qx plus iqy times the derivative, which I call v. And if I look back at my matrix, I notice that I actually have at low energies. So when my energy is low, I'm close to the Dirac point. What I have is, let's say, k dot sigma psi k. So k dot sigma, because I have qx here, and iqy, and minus iqy. So that should remind you of QED, for example. I didn't have a photon, but I have the Dirac fermions. It has no mass. And let me just erase something. Maybe I'll just write it here. So I actually have 2 Dirac points. Next to 1 Dirac point, so let's say H low energy, next to 1 Dirac point is going to look like what I just wrote, sigma dot k, sigma k. And the other one, so that depends where I choose it to be. But let's say I choose it here, minus this point. What I'll have is minus sigma x kx plus sigma y ky. And I'm suppressing, so this is k prime, big K prime. So I'm suppressing spin indices and what else? Yeah. So basically very similar. And if you want to, you can even define 4x4 matrices and see that you can write a Lie algebra with these 4x4 matrices. For most purposes, it's even okay to look at one cone, even though, for example, for scattering, we have to realize that we might scatter from one cone to another. So it is important to remember that there are 2 cones, and they're not exactly equivalent. Now, and there's the velocity, which I set to 1 for now. So let's say v is equal 1 to make our life easier. It actually would look like the following. So let's say it's kx plus iky here. It's going to be kx minus iky here times e to the 2 pi I over 3. And then here, it's going to be kx plus iky again times e to the 4 pi I over 3, and so on. So every time you do that, you change the sign. Oh, sorry. You change the sign of kx, and you add a phase factor. So as you go around, you see different dispersions. But since we know that these 2 are equivalent, we can just look at 2 non-equivalent Dirac points. Yeah.
In the Lagrangian, the things are multiplying k. Which letter is that?
Sorry?
Which letter is that? Sigma?
That's sigma, yeah. So this is sigma is here a 2-dimensional vector of Pauli matrices. Yeah, so here, sigma x is sigma y. Yeah. Do they look more like 6?
I think gamma.
Okay. Okay, so now we're not exactly done. We're only starting. And the one thing that we didn't say is, what do the eigenstates look like? So if you did some Dirac physics before, you might already know that. Let me just say, let's take this out. So we have, as we assumed before, we have e to the ik. So let's say this is a k. K dot r. Let's say psi k k plus k of r. So what I'm giving you is a wave function of momentum which is next to the k valley. At any point on the lattice, and it has this form. Now, what is phi k? Phi k is the argument of k. The argument of a vector is basically, if this is my vector k, it's the angle with respect to the x-axis. This is phi k. Or in other words, in other words, e to the I phi k is kx plus iky over the magnitude k. So it's basically like saying that I have a two-dimensional complex space, and I'm giving this angle in the complex space through this phase factor. Now, this is for positive energy. So let's say plus minus E here, and it will give me plus or minus. And let me call that chirality angle. If I go to the other valley, prime plus k, it's going to be proportional to 1 plus minus, again, or actually minus plus, e to the minus I phi k. So in the other valley, things switch roles. So something that looks more like a positive energy here because of that positive sign is gonna be opposite here. Okay, so, yeah, it's gonna be on the negative energy side, and also the angle changes direction. So what does that mean? That actually means that our pseudospin, and what I want to call the pseudospin is the spinner. In the AB sublattice space, the pseudospin actually has the same direction as the momentum in spin space, though. But how do we measure how do we calculate the direction in spin space? I have this vector. I just sandwich it with the Pauli matrices, okay, to know the direction. So, for example, if I want to find, you know, my, let's say, call it Sx, I would just do psi sigma x psi, and you'll see right away that you have 1 e to the minus I phi k, and then 1 e to the I phi k, for example. If I take one of them, so I'll have 1 e to the I phi k minus I phi k, and then e to the I phi k 1. And what you'll get, and let me just divide it by 2 to normalize, and what you'll get is cosine phi k, which is basically kx over k. It's the projection of my momentum on the x direction. And if I did the same with the sigma y Pauli matrix, I'll get that Sy is actually Ky over K. So the ratio between the expectation value of the pseudo spin on sigma x and sigma y is the same as the ratio between the Kx and Ky. So we basically say that the spin points in the momentum direction. So if I want to illustrate that, let's say I'm in this K, I have my spin always pointing, so let's say this is our energy that we're looking at. Spin is always pointing outwards, like the momentum. But what happens negative energy state is exactly the opposite. So my spins are pointing inwards. So this is in one valley, and actually in the other valley, the opposite happens. The states that are pointing inwards are in the positive energy, and the states that are pointing outwards are in the negative energy. So this is chirality, and actually it has some profound implications on various quantities that we're interested in. And this is something new to condensed matter community. You haven't maybe done too many examples of simple parabolic bands, but what people are used to is that if you have a Fermi surface, you have electrons, they are all born equal, they can scatter between one another, you can excite from one state to another, and the only thing that limits you usually is conservation of energy. Momentum is not conserved while in the moment you add some impurities or some disorder, so you can usually just scatter wherever you want. In graphene, on the other hand, note that there's also pseudospin. So if a state is scattered to another state, one should take into account the overlap between the two states. And if two states have the exactly opposite spins, they will not scatter into one another. And this is just a little preview for tomorrow. For example, in graphene, if you just look closely, this state cannot scatter into this state. So you can reverse momentum, but you will not have any probability for this to happen. Or if you want, I can put it this way. K and minus K around the same valley do not overlap. The two states do not overlap if you stay within the same energy in the same valley. And this is actually a consequence of the Dirac physics that is called the Klein paradox, that there's no backscattering in a Dirac system. And we'll go over that tomorrow. Just one more thing that I think I didn't mention. That if you slice, so I have a three-dimensional plot of the energy versus momentum. If I slice it in two dimensions, I will see, let's say I slice it in the kx direction, I will see the two valleys, k and k prime. And then at half filling, what you will see is that everything here is full. And of course, there are more states. Actually, there are more states. More states here and there. Because I need to basically project everything onto that direction. but all of the states here are full and all of the states here are empty. This is a very special point. If you take interactions, for example, at this point, they have really profound results, and they really change the physics, because this point is very delicate, because the density of states goes to zero here, and so on. In your tutorial, you'll calculate the density of states and other things. Let me just give you some numbers. This hopping amplitude is about 2.3 EV, which makes this around 14 EV. This is important mainly to know whether your linearized model works, because it stops working at some point. And if you want to explain an experiment, for example, then you have to know where the Fermi level lies. Can I still use my Dirac Hamiltonian, or do I have to take into account the banding of the bands, for example? This velocity that I set to 1 here, the velocity is root 3 over 2 TA, and it's about 10 to the 6 meters per second, which is very high. Usually, we don't get that high. In three dimensions, you might get such Fermi velocity. But in two dimensions, since the carrier density is relatively low, relatively you're close, usually you're close to some bottom of the bands are shallow, and you get a very small velocity. It could be orders of magnitude smaller than that. And this is good news. This basically leads to high mobility. This is why some excitement on the experimental part. It's high mobility even when the samples are not very clean, even when they're rippled. So good for applications. So I think we can end here today. Anyone has any questions, comments? Okay, so let me just say, please ask all through the lecture. Don't be shy. And if you have questions, there's people here and myself to help you with whatever. Okay, see you tomorrow.